On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Destiny Watford is a winner of the 2016 Goldman Environmental Prize for her work with Free Your Voice, a grassroots organization that opposed construction of an incinerator in Curtis Bay. The Goldman Prize is awarded to one person on each of the six inhabited continents. Destiny Watford, at age 20, is this year's winner for all of North America. She joins us to talk about lighting a fire for justice in South Baltimore. Then, yesterday marked the 53rd anniversary of the March on Washington. This morning, Helena Hicks recalls the sit-in of Reed's Drugstore that took place a full 8 years before Dr. King's famous I Have a Dream speech. Plus, in Annapolis, a troupe of three actors offer the complete works of William Shakespeare. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Today, we revisit a story about the successful multi-year campaign to prevent a massive incinerator from being built in the South Baltimore neighborhood of Curtis Bay. The young woman who was one of the leaders of that fight is Destiny Watford. She was 16 years old when she started organizing against the incinerator that would have been built in her neighborhood and near her school. In April of this year, Destiny, now 20 years old and a student at Towson University, was awarded the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize for her tireless campaign against the incinerator. The Goldman is a global prize awarded to one person on each continent. Destiny was the winner for all of North America. The prize comes with more than just unparalleled prestige. It also comes with a cash award of $175,000 to support her ongoing work. Pretty amazing stuff. We spoke last May. Fern Chen, the founder and editor of the Baltimore Brew, joined us as well. She's been writing about the incinerator project for the past 6 years. So, Destiny, talk about what the ill effects of this incinerator would have been had your campaign not succeeded.
Yeah, I mean, the incinerator would have been burning 4,000 tons of trash every day. And all of this trash or this garbage wouldn't even be coming from Baltimore. It would be coming from outside of Baltimore. I mean, it was permitted to release 240 pounds of brain-damaging mercury and 1,000 pounds of lead, which we all know from the crisis in Flint, how detrimental lead can be to our health. So the group that I'm a part of, For Your Voice, which is a student-led group based out of my high school, Benjamin Franklin, we saw the incinerator and we studied it and we studied our community's history. And what we learned was that the incinerator really was a violation of our basic human right to live in a healthy community and was a violation of our right to breathe clean air. When we studied our community, we had learned that just because we live in Curtis Bay, we are more likely to die of lung cancer, to suffer from asthma. And that wasn't okay. It wasn't fair. And we knew that we had to do something about it because the incinerator would only make it worse.
And the incinerator project was fairly far along once you got involved in opposing it, wasn't it? I mean, this had been approved by the Maryland Department of the Environment. It had been approved. It had gotten all the permits and stuff. When you say it was permitted to allow these toxins to be used, that was actually within the guidelines that the environmental agencies that oversee this thing allow. How did you come to know that this was going to happen and find out that this was going to be so deleterious?
So we actually found out through a Baltimore Brew article. We found out that, you know, the project was proposed back in 2009. But by the time that we learned about it, 2012, because the project was a complete and utter failure, it wasn't constructed and it wasn't built. So there's this long process of the project getting more permit, stalling, not having those permits anymore, and then reapplying. And when we learned about it, we were just a group of high school students. And like you said, like, we were up against a lot. I mean, like, incineration is considered renewable energy in Maryland. Our previous governor, Governor O'Malley, who ran for president on a green platform, supported the project as did our mayor. 22 public entities, including the Baltimore City Public School System, which we were a part of, would have been buying energy from the project.
Yeah, so there are a lot of people who had buy-in to this. And Fern Shen, you have been writing about this for a long time. Mm-hmm. Take us back to the sort of initial history of this thing. There's this firm from Albany, New York called Energy right. Answers. How did they pop up on the scene with this idea?
They made an application to the state, to the Public Service Commission, to get permission to build and operate this 160-megawatt, I guess, their ultimate capacity they could go to, trash-to-energy power plant. And, you know, the term incinerator came along afterwards of people looking at it and realizing this is going to burn trash and we're going to breathe it. But originally, it was really posed as an energy-producing and even green in the way it was described.
And it was green because it would eliminate the need for landfill.
It would clear landfill space. So that was sort of the positive reaction came about as a result of that. The mayor, the governor, there was a ribbon cutting, and both of them came and spoke and supported it there. Later in our reporting, we noted how much, you know, each of them got in campaign contributions, and also the Democratic Governors Association also got contributions from this Albany-based company. That was the beginning. And there were also meetings in the community where there was some division. There were a lot of people sort of talking about their health problems, other people talking about the potential jobs that would come from this and saying we should approve it because of that.
So what happens, Destiny, what you initially started to do was you first of all went to the school system and you had a meeting with the school board and you said this isn't a very good idea, and they agreed with you. You were able to convince them. Then you went to 21 other entities that had contracts to buy energy from this energy-producing plant. What was your first reaction when you would go to these entities, these companies? Some of them were nonprofit arts organizations, for example. I understand the BMA, the Baltimore Museum of Art, was one of them. How did they first react when you presented them with the consequences of buying energy from this new place?
I guess the reaction we typically got was one that we see a lot when we were canvassing. Really, I mean, like, how many people do you know question where their trash goes? Because I didn't when I started the project. And it was that similar sort of reaction, at least like initial reaction, of not really questioning it, which is what our campaign and what the solutions that we've come up with is all about. Questioning why are we dealing with waste in this way? Why and how can we produce energy in a way that doesn't harm others? So it was just asking that question, but also working together within our communities and with schools from across the city to really change the hearts and minds of like the people who made decisions, but also of folks within our own communities, making it absolutely clear that the incinerator, when it was proposed as something that was green, as something that would be renewable, that would resolve the waste and energy crisis.
Yeah, it looked good. It was approved by all these agencies. I mean, what could be wrong?
Right. But I think one of the coolest things that I'm really, really proud of our campaign is that we have helped ourselves and other people see that the incinerator and developments like it are failures. They're sending us in the wrong path forward. And we have to really look at true alternatives if we're ever going to progress.
So, Fern Shen, this all happened around the time of the recession. And actually what Destiny's group, For Your Voice, was able to do was to get the permit withdrawn. Right? Because it turns out that they had gone longer than 18 months without progressing with the project. That's the thing that actually finally squashed the deal.
Right.
Do I have that right?
Right, yeah. MDE declared it expired. They recognized what, you know, really was the reality, which was this 18 months had passed, well over 18 months, with no construction activity happening over there. And, you know, some people looking at this sort of say, well, it was the economy. They weren't going to do anything anyway. Maybe they couldn't get a bank loan. But for whatever reason, that, I guess, was your procedural wedge, was the fact that they had let so long go on without any construction activity there.
So the permit expired. And you're not just opposing this incinerator, you're also proposing a different use. What are your ideas for how that land and how that area should be used?
The land itself is 90 acres. So, I mean, something that we've said a lot is that that site could be the site of the nation's largest incinerator, or it could be a solar farm, a recycling plant, a composting facility. I can talk about that more in a second, but I really want to emphasize the importance of these solutions that we're talking about and these alternatives that we're talking about, because we recognized early on in the campaign that it wouldn't be enough to just stop the incinerator. I mean, so many developments like the incinerator have come into our community, pushed people out of their homes and sacrificed our lives and our health in the process.
Yeah, any number of people in Curtis Bay have been displaced to build chemical plants and stuff that have other biohazards over the years. I mean, there's a long history of that in your neighborhood.
Within the Curtis Bay region, So there used to be two communities, Ragnar's Point and Fairfield, that were pushed out, no longer exist. I say that because, you know, the Goldman Prize, it's amazing that we won, and I'm really, really proud. But what that prize highlights is that there is a problem that we're facing, which is how we deal with waste and how we produce energy. I mean, right now, the deaths related to air pollution in Baltimore is higher than the homicide rate. And 1/3 of the air pollution in Baltimore is from the incinerator that we already have. The things that we toss away, things that could be recycled, most of it goes to that incinerator. We have this amazing opportunity to create developments that would benefit our communities, that would create jobs, more jobs than the incinerator ever would, and, you know, that don't put our lives at risk. I remember, so when we went to San Francisco, we had a tour of this.
This is last month when you went to receive the prize, the Goldman Prize.
Huh? Yeah, so there's this tour that goes along with the Goldman Prize. And I took a tour of this recycling plant called Recology. And it really was moving how to see an alternative to how we can deal with waste. And also we had the chance to meet, you know, employees that work there. And so many times when I hear about, or when we would canvas and meet here, community members say, you know, well, we need the incinerator because we need jobs. Going to this plant really helped me to understand that there doesn't have to be a sacrifice of health or jobs. We can respect our right to live in a healthy community, but also produce a lot of jobs at living wages, and that people are actually happy and dignified in those jobs. By going to Recology, I also, you know, learned about the relationship that I don't really see as much here in Baltimore between, like, strong relationships with the community, with businesses, and with the government in making sure that these rights are protected and are respected. And I think it would be a true disservice to us in the future of Baltimore if we don't push for things like recycling, like composting, that benefit us.
It's just been a few weeks since you were awarded this huge chunk of change, $175,000. Have you thought about what you're going to do with that money, how you're going to allocate it?
I mean, we're still trying to figure it out, but the idea is to use it to push for what we're fighting for, which is the right to live in a healthy community, which is positive developments like recycling and composting. So we are working to bring developments that would bring a lot of jobs, and not just any jobs, but well-paying jobs.
Towson University student Destiny Watford is winner of the 2016 Goldman Environmental Prize for her work with Free Your Voice, a grassroots organization formed to oppose construction of an incinerator in Curtis Bay. Fern Shen is founder and publisher of the Baltimore Brew, an independent online news source. We spoke last May. We've got more information and links to Destiny Watford's work and to Fern's reporting on the failed efforts to build what many believe would have been the nation's largest trash incinerator. Come to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, a conversation with Baltimore civil rights pioneer Helena Hicks, who recounts her role in a 1955 sit-in that helped to desegregate the Reed's drugstore chain. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
We shall not. We shall not be moved. We shall not. We shall not be moved like a tree that's planted by the water. We shall not be moved.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. In the early years of the civil rights movement, men often overshadowed the women who played pivotal roles as activists and organizers. In January, I spoke with one woman who was front and center in the fight for equal rights in Baltimore, Dr. Helena Hicks. She grew up in Sandtown, Winchester, and she has spent a lifetime agitating for civil rights. In 1955, Ms. Hicks and some fellow students entered a whites-only Reed's drugstore in Baltimore to escape the cold as they waited for a bus that would take them to school at what is now Morgan State University. Their action at Reed's took place 5 years before the more well-known sit-in at a Woolworth's lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina. Knowing that Reed's did not allow people of color in their stores, I asked Dr. Hicks if she and her friends were afraid about what might happen when they walked through those doors.
Morgan had a history of civil rights protests, and I came out of a family that had been a part of civil rights protests. So the fear factor had left me many, many years ago. And so I said, I'm cold, we're going in here. We had on stockings and coats and skirts because ladies didn't wear pants. So you were cold standing out there.
Yeah.
And the worst they can do is put us out. And I wasn't afraid of being put out. I wasn't afraid of what they may say. You get a tough shell. You hear that kind of abuse so much when you do civil rights, you're paying attention to it. So, yes, they were abusive. They called us names, said, you niggas, get out of here. You know you don't belong in here. We can't serve you. And the waitresses disappeared. I think they did not want the engagement. We sat there motionless and speechless. So there was no confrontation from our standpoint. We just sat there trying to get warm. And one person came out and invited us out. We didn't move. And then finally from the, I guess, balcony area, the manager, I believe, came down and told us we weren't allowed in there. The store didn't admit blacks. And, I think we were Negroes then. We've been many things. I think we were Negroes then.
Yeah.
And so the Negroes weren't allowed. And he finally, when we figured that we have exasperated him enough, we got up and left and went back out on the corner and went on to school.
So it's not like you woke up that morning and said, okay, we're going to have a protest at Reed's drugstore.
Oh, no.
You woke up that morning and said, we're going to go to class.
That's right. Right?
So you eventually leave Reed's. About how long were you in there all told?
It was probably just about 20 minutes.
You got a little bit warmer, I would imagine.
We got a little warm. It was no more at max 30 minutes.
But you didn't speak to them. You didn't.
We didn't speak talk to them.
And then you sat down. They spoke to you, and then you got up 20 minutes later and left.
Yeah, and only when we realized the, I don't know how many threats they made about calling the police, but we judge by the mannerisms of the manager and the tone of his voice that he had it, and he was really going to call the police.
Was there a clear leader of the group? Did it emerge that there was sort of one person that you all looked to get cues?
Well, I was the leader because I was the one who
was
lived in Baltimore all the time. And I knew what the policies were. And I also knew that they knew I had been involved in other civil rights activities on campus. So I was, the leader. I was the one who said, let's go in, see what happens.
There were seven of you.
There were seven of us.
Were any of them from, were they all from Baltimore? Some
no,
were not, right?
No, they were from various parts of the area, the region, all the way down to someone from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Ironically, yes.
And she is the only other living person who was on that line.
And what is her name?
Her name is Geraldine Leek Harris. And she often said that she went home that summer and told them what we had done. And she says they got the idea from her because she told them, said they didn't know anything about sit-ins. They didn't know anything about protests. And I told them that's what we had done. She said, I don't think they believed me. But it was a little article in the paper. So they believed her. And she said, I was the one who told them that you can do this and get away with it.
And they did.
Yeah. So they probably did.
Yeah.
They probably owe it to her.
Back to Reed's. You leave the store. You were worried that the manager was going to call the police.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't call the police. Who did he call instead?
He called the school. I thought he would call the school. So we were trying to figure out on the bus We were trying to get our tail together, as young people do. How are we going to cover the fact that we're going to be late for class? And how are we going to cover whatever the president says about us being anything but respectful and role models as Morgan students to the black community? So we didn't really have a good tale to tell him, so we just told the truth. And his reaction and all of the reaction of the faculty was, there's nothing wrong with what you did. We're proud of what you did. But we're disappointed that you didn't realize that nobody knew where you were or what you were doing. And if anything happened, you could not have gotten any help. And so,
because the potential for violence was certainly very real.
Yes, it was. And Pine Street Station, two blocks away, was one of the worst police stations in the history of the city. I mean, it was a horrible place physically, but they had a history of violence against blacks. I mean, that was what they did. They locked you up there and mistreated you, regardless of what you were locked up for. It takes you back to what they say is going on when young people are taken in front of the police or encounter the police now, and the kind of behavior. That's what existed with police in Baltimore City then. It's nothing new about that.
Yeah. A few days later, the policy at Reed's changed, didn't it?
They desegregated all of the stores. They knew that was the bus stop for students going to Morgan. And they knew that that was just the beginning of all the things ahead in terms of forcing them by confrontation to desegregate that store. So rather than go through that, they just desegregated all the stores, even those that were in white neighborhoods.
And once Reed's was desegregated, what was the reaction of the president of Morgan and your fellow students at Morgan when they heard that news?
Well, they were very elated because the attitude was, we were a big family and it's look what we did. Not look what you did or look what you and your friends did, but look what we did. And so it was a real good feeling. What it did was push people to rapidly make all the challenges.
And then did that that increase in the frequency of these movements then pick up right away?
It picked up because we went back in April to make sure they hadn't changed their mind and we could go in and sit at the count. Mm-hmm. So it was that kind of thing. And I think they knew, you know, we got to get on this.
At that point, by April, so this is now 4 months after the action, you could sit at the counter. Would they serve you food?
Yes.
Yeah. So it was completely desegregated in that way.
We weren't sure we wanted to eat it.
Yeah, I bet.
Because we didn't know
what they put in it.
Even though there were blacks who worked in those stores, in the kitchens and whatnot, you just didn't trust.
At that time, it was legally admissible, allowed to separate blacks and whites and disallow black people from coming into stores. But not all of the stores did that.
That's true. Some
of them didn't. And there was a whole subtle code that you had to be hip to, wasn't there? I mean, you had to know which stores allowed you to do A, B, and C, and another store may just allow you to do A and B, and another store will allow you to do none of them. But how did you even keep track of that? Isabel Wilkerson talks about this in her wonderful book, Warmth of Other Suns, about just knowing the nuances from block to block and store to store.
Yeah, and that's why I said they looked to me, because I was involved. I knew the laws and I knew the consequences of breaking them. But I knew that we could go in McCroy's and buy something. They had a lunch counter too. We couldn't eat in there. I knew we could go in the stores that sold clothing. We could buy clothing. We couldn't try it on. But I also knew other things. And the wife of the civil rights leader, Walter Carter, Sarita Richardson Carter, was my classmate. She worked in one of the stores down the street from Reed's. And what she said to me was, they, as an employee, she was going to Morgan, working her way through school. not only could those of us on the outside not do these things, as an employee, she could buy her food in the store, but she had to take it to where they hung their coats and, you know, like a janitorial area to eat it. Even as an employee, even if the store was not yet open, she could not eat at the lunch counters. So nobody would let you eat in any of the stores downtown.
The buses. We certainly know about segregation in buses in other parts of the country, but when you hopped on that number 3 bus to get out to Morgan, were the buses segregated?
No. You could sit wherever you could find a seat. And you did not have to get up if a white person didn't have a seat. No. What happened was they would not let the bus come down to Morgan campus. We had to get off at Northwood and walk the rest of the way to the campus.
That's a hefty walk from Northwood Avenue, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's like maybe
half a mile, something
about
like that.
About a half a mile, yeah.
And in the cold and stuff.
All kinds of weather.
Yeah.
We could not, they would not give us bus transportation.
What was the next civil rights action then that you were involved in after Reed's in January of 1955?
After that, I think the next was probably in, 1957, when I started Howard University to work on my master's. And Walter Carter was one of the few people who had a car, and we were going to Howard University School of Social Work together, riding back and forth. And Walter would stop the car anywhere along Route 1 and said, let's go in here and see if they'll serve us. We never got served anyplace. But the point was, we did the challenge all the time. So we were continuing the challenge.
So you just did this on a regular basis on your way to school?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I used to say I was a captive audience. I needed to ride, so I couldn't. I had to follow, but really, you know, those of us in the car. And what the next one in Baltimore was in, it was maybe 58 or 59 when we picketed the Hippodrome. So we picketed as Howard students with Walter Carter, we picketed the Hippodrome because they wouldn't let us in to sit down. And people don't realize that.
And this is almost 20 years after the picketing of Ford's Theater.
That's right.
In the early 40s.
That's right. Yeah. So I participated in picketing the Hippodrome.
Mm-hmm. And what was the result of that?
They opened their doors.
On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning. We're listening to a conversation I had in January with Dr. Helena Hicks about the early days of the Civil Rights Movement. She was part of a group of college students who helped to desegregate the Reed's drugstore chain back in 1955. Dr. Hicks grew up in a household in which protesting for equal rights was a frequent endeavor.
The first protest I was in was in 1942, holding my mother's hand, and I have the newspaper picture of that. She was picketing Ford's Theater.
On Pennsylvania Avenue.
No, yes, she was picketing Ford's Theater to be able to go in and sit down in the second balcony. It was even on the first floor. So I have this picture in the traditional lady. She has on a coat with a fur collar, traditional fox fur collar, and her hat. She's holding my hand. And it was winter, and I'm shriveled up against her. And she's teaching me, really, without purposely knowing she was doing that. You know, this is what you do when people don't treat you with respect.
Dr. Hicks talked about the difference between what was at stake for her generation and what is at stake when young people protest today.
Young people think what they do when they go with their placards and shout and holler and scream, that really is a big deal. They don't understand the personal sacrifice that we went through so that they can do what they're doing now. Their lives weren't threatened. They weren't locked up. They weren't mistreated. They didn't risk not getting a job, a school. None of that applied to them because they are not breaking laws. You do have a right to picket. You didn't have a right to picket when we started that. There was no such right. That was breaking the law.
So what is your reaction, your opinion, your feeling about movements of today, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement, in which some people have been arrested and some people have been put in jail during protests for various reasons. But as you, from your vantage point, having been involved with civil rights, you know, from the 40s and 50s, when you see these kids now in 2014, 15, and the actions that they're doing to, for example, address issues of police misconduct. What do you think about that?
Well, it's interesting because I went to a meeting in West Baltimore. Must have been at least 100 people in the room. They were all geared up, protesting all the things that they wanted government to change to make life more equal and just for blacks. Everything from education to crime to health, just the whole gamut of things. And what I said to them was, you have to learn how to do civil disobedience. And they said, you know, they talked about they're planning a protest for this time. And I said, you don't need to play in anything. I said, you want to picket? Picketing is a legal right. Get a paper bag. Put on the paper bag what you want, stick it on a broomstick, and start walking in front of wherever it is you think is not giving you the respect you deserve. And they didn't understand that. I said, that's why you get into trouble. You have to learn civil disobedience. That's an art. It's not just going out there, walking up and down and shouting and all of it. You get arrested because you don't have the self-control that we had. We knew how to be silent, to turn it off, to let them be the aggressive, mad men or women, and we remain the civil, sane person. They don't understand that art.
So you think it's a matter of tactics and strategy when it comes to the to the Black Lives Matter movement in particular?
Yes, I think that young people do not want to listen to the wisdom of the elderly.
What do you think the focus should be for today's civil rights activists? What are the compelling issues from your perspective that people involved in fight for justice and social justice and equality, how should they prioritize the work that they're doing?
I guess it's a matter of who you talk to. I always say it's education. Because if you don't start when children are 3 and 4, helping them understand they have rights and what they are and how do you get what you want without being a potential candidate for violence. If you don't start then helping them understand that you, if you want to be treated with respect, you have to demand it.
Civil rights activist Dr. Helena Hicks was one of the participants in the sit-in at Reed's Drugstore in Baltimore in 1955. We spoke last January. We've got more information on our website at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up, theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review of the complete works of Shakespeare, Abridged, at the Annapolis Shakespeare Company. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
And welcome back. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. It's Monday morning. That means it's time to check in with our intrepid theater critic, J. Wynn Russick. Hey, Judy, how you doing?
Fine, thank you, Tom.
So you have wandered down to Annapolis to see the Annapolis Shakespeare Company's production of the complete works of all things, of William Shakespeare, Abridged.
Yes.
That's the title. All right. So they're at the Reynolds Tavern down there in Annapolis. So this is obviously an enormous undertaking, the complete works of Shakespeare. I'm glad to hear the word abridged at the end of it. So just how abridged? How do they put this thing together?
Well, some are way, way, way abridged down to just a title or maybe even just a word in the title. I started out kind of trying to keep track of the plays, but some of them go by so fast they actually got away from me. A couple of the plays, Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet, get a little more attention, and some of them are grouped together. The comedies are grouped together and the histories are grouped together. 16 comedies are dispatched in one omnibus bit that is titled, hang on, The Comedy of Two Well-Measured Gentlemen Lost in the Merry Wives of Venice on a Midsummer's Twelfth Night in Winter. And when the history plays come up, one actor asks, why can't this Shakespeare stuff be more like sports? So the history plays become a football game. At one point, King Lear shows up and a penalty is called, fictional character on the field. But here's a bit of Shakespeare's history plays as a football game, one of my favorite bits.
And the crown is snapped to Richard II, that well-spoken 14th century monarch. He's fading back to pass, looking for an heir downfield, but there's a heavy rush from King John.
My gross flesh sinks downward.
The crown is in the air, and Henry VI comes up with it.
Victory is mine.
But he's hit immediately by King John. Oh, no, he's cutting Henry VI into three parts. That's gotta hurt. This could be the end of the War of the Roses cycle.
All right, a little abridgment of the complete works of William Shakespeare with the cast of the Annapolis Shakespeare Company. Speaking of the cast, Shakespeare's plays, I mean, even the littlest ones, the shortest ones, they still have lots and lots of characters. So how many actors are actually in the cast of the complete works? How many does it take to do the complete works of Shakespeare?
Well, believe it or not, Tom, it only takes three.
So even the actors are abridged.
Yes, yes, exactly. Three actors under the direction of Annapolis Shakespeare's artistic director, Sally Boyette. Here's the way it was divided up the night I was there. An actor named Johnny Weisgerber plays all of the women, most of whom seem to have some kind of regurgitation problem. He plays everyone from Juliet to Ophelia to Hamlet's mother. He also plays Hamlet's father. He wears a long flowing wig and a beard at the same time. An actor named Brian Keith McDonald starts out playing a Shakespeare scholar, and later he plays Hamlet. And an actor named Matthew Pauly serves kind of as an MC in addition to playing Shakespearean characters. At the end of the first act, the other two abandon poor Matthew Pauly, and he has to come up with filler, which is pretty funny, but even in this kind of over-the-top spoof, I found that he sometimes overdid the over-the-top stuff. I also want to give a shout-out to Bill Dennison, who handles the props and helps the actors in and out of costumes and wigs, which in this piece is no small task.
Yeah, indeed. Sounds like it. So we just heard, for example, the history play is done as a football game. I take it this show features a wide range of performance styles, as we may say.
Oh, yes, yes. Very, very, very wide. Besides the football game, there's a cooking show, and there's a rap/human beatbox version of Othello. I mean, who knows? If Shakespeare were writing today, I bet he would be writing rap. So I brought you a bit of the Othello rap.
Now Othello got married to Desdemona,
but he took her for the wars and he left her alone.
It was a Mona,
a Drona. He left her alone.
He didn't write a letter and he didn't telephone her.
It reminds me of Steve Martin got a condo made of Stona in a move to Arizona, King Tut. So that was the Annapolis Shakespeare productions of the complete works of William Shakespeare, abridged. Now, by the way, this is not a new piece, right? I mean, how long has it been around? What's the deal
with this? It's actually been around for more than 30 years. It's written by a company called the RSC, and no, that is not the Royal Shakespeare Company. That is the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
There you go.
They started out performing at Renaissance fairs in the early 80s, and a few years later they came up with an even more abridged version than this, a one-hour version of the complete works written by Adam Long, Daniel Singer, and Jess Winfield. They're the three founding members of Reduced Shakespeare. And then they expanded it into two acts. They've been at the Kennedy Center a lot. This past April, in honor of Shakespeare's 400th anniversary of his death, they debuted a piece called William Shakespeare's Long-Lost First Play.
abridged at the Folger in Washington. People who are really into this can also get a chance to see the complete history of America abridged in January. The Vagabonds are doing it.
All right. So they must own like a copyright on the word abridged or something. Right? So now, do you have to know Shakespeare? I mean, you were sitting there saying that you're trying to keep track of all the plays and all that. You would know those, right? But a person like me and probably a lot of folks listening wouldn't know. I mean, what if you don't know intimately the complete works or even some of the works of William Shakespeare? How do you make out?
Well, it helps definitely to know most of the works, or at least some of the works. But as I said, two of the plays that get more attention, Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet, are probably the best known Shakespeare plays. Most people have some familiarity with that. They have audience interaction in that, and that always has a certain wild appeal. For Othello, we all get to represent different parts of Ophelia's superego, and they bring an audience member up by herself to represent Ophelia's id. Hamlet, they do faster and faster, and then they do it backwards. So here's one of the great lines from that. Be to not or be to. But I brought you a sample of the speed Shakespeare rendition of Hamlet.
Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt.
My lord, I think I saw your father yesternight.
Would the night were come.
Boo, mock me.
Something is rotten in the state of Denmark.
Revenge my murder.
My lord, this is strange.
Well, there are more things in heaven and earth ratio, so piss off. To be or not to be, that is
good, my lord.
Get thee to a nunnery.
Whoa.
Now speak the speech, tripping me on the tongue.
Give her the play.
I'll take the ghost's word for £1,000. Now, mother, what's the matter?
What will thou do? Thou wilt not murder me. Help.
Help, help.
And now, a rat dead for a ducat.
All right, so if you're in a hurry and you're interested in a little Shakespeare, education, seems like a good bet. All right, so they're performing this piece, The Complete Works of William Shakespeare Abridged, outdoors at a place called Reynolds Tavern. Does that add to the experience?
Oh, yes, absolutely. This is a historic tavern. It doesn't date back quite as far as Shakespeare, but you can imagine a tavern similar to this in Shakespeare's day. And being outdoors lends itself to the broad, over-the-top comedy. If there were scenery to chew in this piece, it would be in shreds. It's that kind of performance. I'm going to give you one last example. I mentioned the cooking show. That is actually the format for Shakespeare's great revenge tragedy. Great is questionable, but Titus Andronicus, a play that includes cannibalism. So it becomes a cooking show called The Gory Gourmet, and Titus says at the end, finger licking good. So if you can watch that while you're eating dinner at the Reynolds Tavern, you know you're having fun.
Having fun or not paying attention. Maybe one of those two things. All right. Well, Judy Russick, always good to see you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
The Annapolis Shakespeare Company, their production of The Complete Works of William Shakespeare Abridged, is at the Reynolds Tavern until the 28th of September. That's it for us today. Coming up Wednesday, researcher Stephanie DeLuca on Coming of Age in the Other America, National Book Award winner James McBride on the legacy of James Brown, and the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle on why the biggest losers lost. That's all coming up Wednesday morning here on Maryland Morning. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Brush up your Shakespeare. Stop quoting him now. Brush up your Shakespeare, and the women you will wow.
Just declaim a few lines from Othello, and she'll think you're a hell of a fella.
If your blonde won't respond when you flatter her, tell her what Tony told Cleopatra.
If she says your behavior is heinous, kick her right into Coriolanus.
Brush up your Shakespeare.